From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Ian Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. All right, we're going to start with some news out of the land of Disney. The company has announced plans to reimagine its Splash Mountain ride at Disneyland and Disney World as the country reckons with symbols of slavery, racism, and racial stereotypes that have really persisted in our culture. Splash Mountain was inspired by the 1946 film Song of the South, which has been widely criticized for its depiction of African Americans. Disney now plans to make over Splash Mountain with a storyline of the 2009 animated movie The Princess and the Frog, famous for Tiana, Disney's first African-American princess. And joining us now for more on this story is Mike Rowe, arts and entertainment editor for LAist. Mike, welcome back.
Hey.
All right, Mike. Now, criticism of the film, Song of the South, nothing new. Protests have happened outside of an Oakland movie theater the year it was released. What was Disney's official line about the movie Song of the South?
I mean, Song of the South has been so widely criticized that Disney has kept it locked up in its vault for years. When Disney Plus launched recently, Disney's Bob Iger, former CEO, now chairman, said that Song of the South wouldn't be available there, despite the trend in streaming services to often include problematic content with some sort of warning to help provide context, like HBO Max did recently with Gone with the Wind. Or, you know, Disney itself has used context and given a warning before Dumbo on the service due to some outdated racial depictions. Bob Iger said that Song of the South was not appropriate in today's world. So it is, you know, not part of Disney Plus. It's not part of, you can't even buy a copy of it. And now you're not going to be able to ride the ride of it eventually.
Well, there's an argument that Song of the South is appropriate in no world ever, but that's something else. Something else entirely. Now that's the movie Song of the South. Let's go to Splash Mountain now. So if you're riding Splash Mountain, in what ways do you see images of the movie Song of the South in the ride?
You know, there are some really detailed animatronics throughout the ride that feature characters like Br'er Rabbit, Br'er Fox, Br'er Bear. They're taken from the movie's animated segments that were part of these sort of old stories that were part of Song of the South. It leaves out the most problematic elements, notably live-action character Uncle Remus and its potentially racist depiction. But it does feature one of the movie's most famous legacies, the song Zippity-Doo-Dah, you'll hear throughout the ride and have stuck in your head as you leave.
Yeah.
But, you know, these characters are not going to be part of it anymore.
So, Mike, what's the plan for the actual implementation of the Princess and the Frog makeover? When Disney finally reopens, will it be Tiana's ride or will it still be in its current state?
It's still going to be in its current state. You know, Disney's Imagineers have been working on this for more than a year, but when they reopen, they say it's still going to open up as Splash Mountain. It's still going to be the way it currently is, both here and at the Magic Kingdom in Florida. They released some concept art and said they've been at work on it, but the Imagineers are still going to conduct some preliminary reviews, according to Disney, and they haven't even figured out a timeline for the remodel yet. You know, whenever it happens, the ride's going to feature music and characters from Princess and the Frog. Some of Splash Mountain's characters actually were already repurposed from another old Disney attraction. So it'll be interesting to see if they keep those characters as part of the ride, but since they don't have those ties to Song of the South, or if they'll want to sort of get a fresh start.
One more thing, Mike. What's been the response to this news today about the changes to the ride? Really quick.
You know, the reaction's been largely positive online, though there are definitely fans who are really attached to it, don't even know the connection to Song of the South, and want to keep this ride a part of their lives.
All right, we're going to go out on a song from The Princess and the Frog. This is Almost There, sung by Anika Noni Rose. Mike Rowe is arts and entertainment editor for LAist. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ain't got time for messing around, and it's not my style. This old town can slow you down, people taking the easy way. But I know exactly where I'm going, getting closer and closer every day. And I'm almost there, I'm almost there. People down here think I'm crazy, but I don't care.
All right, California is projected to lose over $70 billion in visitor spending this year because of the pandemic. That's nearly half of what the state made in tourism in all of 2019. So considering any major travel plans you might have had this summer went away, how about rediscovering home, as in Visit California? The folks at the nonprofit tourism organization Visit California want you to do just that, but they have a few recommendations. Visit California president and CEO Carolyn Batetta, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me,
Sure, sure. Now, I mentioned some of the numbers up top, but what are some real-life examples of just how bad of a hit California tourism has taken in 2020?
Well, I think the other epic crisis we endured, besides all the wildfires and mudslides and earthquakes, was actually 9/11. And this is actually nine times the size of 9/11 in terms of economic impact.
How has tourism tried to survive this? I mean, it just, that feels like a backbreaker kind of fact.
Yes, it's been an enduring, almost slow motion crisis as we were all falling into the crisis and then reached rock bottom with the pause. We call that just the pause when everything had to shut down. And now with this slow climb out of the crisis, and as we're climbing out, of course, it appears that we're being hit with, I don't want to call it a second wave technically, but a spike for sure in COVID cases.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in just a bit. I wanted to ask you, though, before the pandemic hit, Visit California has been working on ways to make the state a leader in what you call sustainable tourism. What does sustainable tourism mean?
Sustainable tourism really addresses the need for what we call destination stewardship, and that is to protect the land and the state we love. We've benefited from incredible visitor spending. Last year, visitors spent $145 billion, and that's fantastic. It creates an economic engine for communities up and down California, but at the same time, we have to make sure we're managing those resources for not only the visitors that have an expectation when they book a trip to California, but the residents alike.
So don't just come, consume, and go. Actually kind of have things in mind. And to that end, you've created the Responsible Travel Code as sort of a guide to plan your trip that's found on your website. And all centers around the word respect. 7 points using each letter in the word respect. So, Carolyn, I'm going to set you up and you do a quick hit description. So let's start with R, and that's roam responsibly.
Well, when you're on vacation, you're roaming. So when you're roaming, take care of the services that are being provided to you.
All right. Educate yourself. That's E in respect.
Embrace community. So, you know, over half of businesses in tourism are small businesses. They're community, just like you and me. So embrace them.
The S is safety first. What does safety first stand for?
Safety first is taking care of yourself, and by taking care of yourself, like wearing a mask, you're taking care of others as well as those small businesses.
Okay, the P in respect is preserve California.
Yeah, preserve the incredible embarrassment of riches that we're so fortunate to live in, you know, and make sure that it's there for the next generations.
The second E in respect, embrace community. Did you want to get into a separate thing about that, or is it all involved with educate yourself too?
We call it educate myself, and that is really pre-trip planning of navigating where you're going and learning the clean and safe protocols in those destinations.
Okay, celebrate culture. That's the C, second to last letter in respect.
Right, have some fun and embrace the incredible inclusiveness and diversity of the California culture.
All right, last letter in respect is teach others.
This whole respect code is only successful if we're passing it along to our friends and family for them to share as well, so that it's cyclical.
All right, now I wanted to go back to the C in respect, the celebrate culture, because it feels, Carolyn, like the timing is kind of perfect for it. How much of that involves trying to economically celebrate culture?
Probably 60% or more of the businesses that you encounter when you're on a vacation, think about restaurants and retail and Main Street. That's the authenticity that we as tourists really seek out on vacations. Entrepreneurs come from all walks of life, and we have a thriving, unique, diverse entrepreneurial community that needs visitor spending to survive and thrive.
We're talking to Visit California President and CEO Carolyn Beteta. Now, okay, how much of a backbreaker would it be for California tourism if things got bad enough that we had to slide back maybe a phase or going back all the way to phase one?
Well, it would be huge. As you said at the opening of your program, this year we're poised to lose about $72 billion in spending, cutting our overall economy, but travel in particular, in half. And so if we were to go backwards, we will see those systemic losses again. I will say there is a silver lining for California, and that is that 72% of our domestic visitation is Californians. So we do have an ability, even sliding back as we recreate in our own communities, to provide an economic stimulus to our respective communities. That's something that a lot of states don't enjoy when they're so centric around one city, such as Las Vegas, Nevada, or New York City, New York. We have an incredible wealth of recreational opportunities all over the state that we can help each other with.
That's Visit California President and CEO Carolyn Beteta. Carolyn, thanks a lot.
Thanks, eh?
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. While many places in Los Angeles have reopened and people are starting to get back out again, the economy is still lagging. For many musicians and entertainers, it means that they are largely still out of work, including mariachis in Los Angeles. Now, sure, some of them are finding work, serenading people on their birthdays and during graduations, but most mariachis will tell you they do not have a lot of gigs on the calendar right now. Carlos Samaniego is the director of Mariachi Arco Iris de Los Angeles, a self-proclaimed LGBTQ+ mariachi band. He's been working on new opportunities for his band to play during the pandemic, but it has been difficult. Here is his story.
Before the pandemic, we had a lot of work. Frankly, we were booked almost every weekend of the year, about, let's say, 90% of the year. The bookings consisted of weddings, quinceañeras, birthday parties, and we also did big events where we did pride festivals, other concerts and shows on big stages. All these types of events, they're not at this time taking place. When this hit, the pandemic, there were a few people in the mariachi who were very, very concerned about their finances and their health. There's at least a couple of people who have underlying health conditions, and they only perform for a living. They don't have another job. So the fact that they weren't going to be making any money to be able to survive and pay their rent and their food, and then at the same time, they were really scared to even go out and do anything, of course, because, you know, they don't want to contract anything. It's just a bad situation all around. I, as a director, I've applied for several grants and loans and tried to get what I can to be able to help them. And fortunately, I was granted one of these loans, which I hope turns into a grant. And I was able to really provide work for them. People started to reach out to me, clients, saying that they want a mariachi. Now, right now, you know, everyone is dealing with the financial impact of the pandemic, so not everyone has lots of money to be able to spend on a mariachi, but they really, really want to be able to bring some joy to their loved ones. And so they asked me, what can they do? And I said, well, as it turns out, we can offer you a pretty big discount. I offered them like a half price discount. Whatever money that the client wasn't able to pay, I was able to subsidize that with the money that I got from this loan. The other thing that we've decided to do, and that I'm also using this money for, is to have the musicians make videos of music. And it's good because it gives people something to do, and they have to wear their suit and get all dolled up and record themselves doing this, and it gives them some work. But at the same time, you know, all of the groups are suffering. There isn't a mariachi out there that isn't going through a huge shortage of work. This mariachi, in specific, Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles, because we are together for several different reasons. One of them is that we're all within the LGBTQ plus community, and we all have this beautiful love and respect for this music, that I think that this group will survive the pandemic.
Carlos Samaniego is the director of Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles, a self-proclaimed LGBTQ plus mariachi band. And the music you're hearing is his band playing a song called Te Parto el Alma. Millions of Southern Californians have lost jobs during the pandemic. That can make it difficult to keep up on gas and electricity bills. For now, the big utilities are barred from disconnecting your service, but when that ends, you could face a very big bill. But some help is on the horizon. It's called Utility Debt Forgiveness. And here to tell us how it all works is KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. Sharon, welcome back.
Hey there, thanks.
All right, now it sounds way too good to be true. Big utility companies willing to make your old unpaid bills disappear. So who is offering that?
It's definitely something new from the state's four big utilities in our area. Those are Southern California Edison and Southern California Gas Company. Their customers can actually take some concrete steps to eliminate their unpaid power and gas bills.
All right, we'll get into the details in 1 minute. But why is this happening right now? Is it because of the job losses because of the pandemic?
Actually, no.
Oh, wow.
Long before the pandemic, the state legislature has been working with consumer advocates to reduce the number of utility shutoffs, the ones that can harm quality of life for the poorest Californians. And disconnections are a big part of that. Southern California Edison has a very high rate. About 8% of all its customers get cut off every year. And those disconnections disproportionately affect Black and Latino families. So this debt forgiveness program is not explicitly done because of the pandemic, but the financial insecurity it's causing will make this program very helpful to some.
All right, so let's get to the nuts and bolts. How does this debt forgiveness work?
So if you're a customer of Edison or SoCalGas and you have outstanding bills, you can get on their debt forgiveness plan. Then you would have to make on-time payments of your normal monthly bill starting next April when the ban on disconnections ends. For every month that you do that, 1/12 of your outstanding debt is erased. So over the course of a year of on-time payments of your regular bill, the entire unpaid debt is eliminated, and that's up to $8,000.
That sounds like it would help a lot of people, Sharon. Okay, so what's the catch? I mean, there's got to be one, right? There's got to be a string that's attached.
Yeah, there are. Not everybody will qualify to erase their utility debt. You have to have $500 or more in unpaid bills, and that debt has to be at least 90 days overdue. You also have to register for one of the rate subsidy programs the utilities offer to low-income families. And if you think you're not low-income, if you recently lost work during the pandemic and have no income, you can qualify. And once you're on the plan, if you miss two consecutive payments, they kick you off and you're back owing the money.
So wait, okay, are you saying that if you stop paying your bill today and ran up a debt of over $500 by April, you would not be disconnected and you could apply for a program to eliminate the unpaid bills?
Yes, indeed. But remember, only if you're low income.
Okay.
The state regulator's decision to do this debt program says that it's pretty unusual to owe more than $500 to a utility company. And for example, in March of this year, there were only about 2,900 households that would have qualified in Edison's very large service territory. But with the pandemic, job losses, and people using more energy staying at home, that number of people could rise. Edison expects about 15,000 people to qualify for the debt forgiveness.
All right. One more question, Sharon. This debt forgiveness applies to only Edison and SoCalGas customers. What about people who get their electricity from LADWP?
Nope. LADWP is a city-owned utility. It's not regulated by the state. So DWP customers are not being offered any kind of debt forgiveness right now. And a spokeswoman told me that by law, they cannot make paying customers cover the bills of those who don't pay. But they are looking at federal disaster relief money coming in to see if maybe that could be a source of debt forgiveness. But they're making no promises.
All right. That's KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. She's got a lot more detail about the debt forgiveness program and plan on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
And now the next installment in a series of stories profiling influential members of Southern California's many distinctive diaspora communities. Tensions between Iran and the U.S. earlier this year left many Iranian Americans on edge. And no one knows that better than Homa Sarshar. The Persian journalist has more than 50 years' experience reporting in Iran and Southern California. KPCC's Aaron Schrank has this profile.
Homa Sarshar has one of those voices. You know, a radio voice.
Subhane ba Homa Sarshar.
Her show, Breakfast with Homa Sarshar, is heard by tens of thousands each Saturday morning on LA's leading Persian radio station. Earlier this year, I meet her at the show's studio in Universal City. As the sun rises, she prepares the day's headlines.
I'm putting together the news, what's going on in the United States, what's going on in Iran, and what's going on the relationship between Iran and the U.S.
There's been a lot going on, especially since U.S. forces assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani at the start of this year. Sarshar's lived in L.A. since 1978, reporting about and for the largest group of Iranians outside of the homeland. L.A.'s Iranian community is religiously and ethnically diverse. Sarshar says the community is also politically divided. There's fierce debate on what exactly they want for Iran's future.
Living here in Los Angeles means that we are against the regime. Our presence here is political because we're against the government. Everybody wants this regime to go, but the way that we want the regime to go is different.
Sarshar says she tries to showcase the varying perspectives. She tries to be a fair journalist.
And this is what I was striving all my life to be, because I think one of the most important reasons for revolution to happen in Iran was that the voice of opposition was shut up.
Sarshar's show isn't just hard news. This morning, collaborator Mandana Zandian is preparing her regular segment on contemporary Persian poetry. Zandian is a cancer doctor and a poet. She says Sarshar has spent decades giving voice to young artists in LA's Persian community.
I'm one of them. When I came from Iran, of course, I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how to continue my Persian literature goals, and she helps people doing that. Almost no one else does it for Persian community, but she does.
When she's not on air, Sarshar is usually planning the program from her 15th floor penthouse in Westwood, where I meet her on a recent afternoon.
I took the best view of the house from my desk.
Yo, this is amazing.
The apartment is filled with Persian art and sculpture, ornate teapots, and baby toys to keep her new granddaughter busy. Sarshar says she found her voice early because she was raised by strong working women in Tehran.
At the time that I started to be a journalist, there was maybe 10 women journalists in my country.
Sarshar started working at 18 at a women's magazine and then a daily newspaper, later at the Iranian state broadcaster. She fled Iran 2 months before the 1979 revolution. She and her husband had been fired from their jobs and their kids' school closed.
We had a sense that something is happening, so we decided to get out of the country and wait until everything settled down and we come back, and this never happened.
Sarshar says she's dedicated her life to the Persian diaspora and to the arts and culture of her homeland. She set up a grant program to help exiled artists and sponsors art exhibits by Iranian-born artists around Southern California. I caught up with her outside the Ebel Theater in Mid-Wilshire.
Looking good. gorgeous as always.
Thank you, thank you.
Sarsar is dressed to the nines, receiving well-wishers like royalty. This play is about famed Persian poet Rumi and his guru, Shams.
I know the two producers, and they asked me if I can give my voice for this.
The crowd spills into the theater. Soon, that signature voice echoes over the loudspeaker. Sarsar wants to preserve her ancient culture. She also wants Iran to change. But she wants that change to come from the inside.
We have been away from that country 40 years. If I go back to Iran, I don't know if I know the people anymore, if we speak the same language anymore. I don't have the right to decide for them.
She can be a voice for Iranian Americans and help keep her culture alive and well in this hub of exiles 7,000 miles from home. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank.
You can meet more influential members of LA's distinctive diaspora communities if you check out the full project on our website. You can find it at las.com/homeland. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Ian Martinez. All right, now that all kids are out of school for the summer, it's time for the next installment in our series about parenting in a pandemic. Now, we've heard that some camps are opening with strict rules around hourly hand washing and frequent temperature checks. That's in addition to masks and social distancing. But still, not all families feel comfortable sending their kids to camp this summer. Others are happening on Zoom. Joining us now to discuss how kids can experience summer while the pandemic continues is Christina Costella. She's the author of the book Designing for Kids, Creating for Playing, Learning, and Growing, and she's also a professor at Art Center College of Design. Christina, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The coronavirus, Christina, has really thrown a curveball in our lives, hasn't it? And I think we really have felt it for months, but now in the summer with kids and you got to figure out what to do with them, it seems like now is really highlighted how much sometimes we're not so prepared for this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, it's a really good time for us to think about all those things that we said that we want to do only if we had the time. You know, oh, I wish we could go camping, or I wish we had more time to spend as a family, or I wish we had time to organize those digital photos that we have thousands of, right? So it's really letting us think outside of the normal box of how we do spend our time and letting us rely more on thinking about what we want to do versus looking out there for an activity and having it set for us.
Now, recently, the marches have brought millions of people to the streets in support of Black Lives Matter. And we still don't know if those marches will trigger a spike in COVID cases. But I'm wondering if you think these protests have shifted the public thinking around how we can live lives outside during the pandemic.
Yeah, so the way that I've been thinking about the pandemic has been really people grappling this whole idea of risk and reward. So is the risk of doing something worth the reward that we're going to get from that experience? And what the marches have pointed to has been, you know, the risk of participating has come with this reward of having to make an impact and challenging what is currently happening in society. So I think that's going to continue to happen. It's just been made more obvious. And we make these choices every day, like whether we're going to the playground versus being at home and taking the risk of our kids being around other kids who don't social distance. But there are, you know, plenty of things that we've seen that we can do if we do keep distances like riding bikes and scooters and maybe seeing friends, but, you know, staying further away from them than we normally would.
You know, in light of the protests, many people online have shared books, TV shows, and movies for kids and adults to better help understand different races and understand each other, especially to understand the history of African Americans in the United States. What's your take, Christina, on integrating this kind of learning into the summer? And how can parents do that without kids rejecting it as, say, maybe school or an extension of school?
Yeah, so informal learning is really important during the summertime. You know, school is considered formal learning where there's an agenda, and informal learning is when you're learning by doing and actively participating in things. And I think it's a really good time to take advantage of learning about these topics at this moment in these historical times. It's going to require for parents to think about the best time for conversations to come up or to make an effort to, say, explore Los Angeles and this ethnically diverse community that we are in a different way than we normally do. But for kids, you know, they're forming their identity and thinking about creating this autobiographical self. And this experience is going to be a part of who they are as they grow up and help them to build empathy.
We're talking to Christina Castella. She's the author of the book Designing for Kids, Creating for Playing, Learning, and Growing. You know, the age of a child plays a role in how we structure their summertime. So I'm wondering, what are some rules of thumb we can consider when thinking about what elementary school kids need socially and emotionally versus, say, middle school kids?
Well, I'll start off by talking a little bit about what they both need. And the most important thing that they both need are peer-to-peer interactions. And again, that is hard to think about how to do that during social distancing, but not impossible. I heard a quote once that, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, not because of all the parents in the village, but because of all the peer groups of kids that are out there in a village, right? So we need to think about that, right? And how do we get our kids around those peer groups? It's important for them to set their own goals and their own schedules and learn to make their own decisions. And then if we think about younger kids, they're more about exploring what they like to do. But older kids are exploring more about who they are. And, you know, middle schoolers are withdrawing more from the family. So having unsupervised time with friends as they're developing a group identity. And they're also more aware of what is happening in the world and how it personally affects them. So participate in events that are important to them, to virtually volunteer, and then also building skills and specialized interests as they get older.
You mentioned that there are two sets of kids, the younger ones who do things that they like to do, as opposed to the older ones who maybe are kind of looking to see who they are and kind of just filling out that part before they start heading into adulthood. So I'm wondering, what's the age where it's kind of tough to figure out, that borderline age where maybe they're leaving one and about to enter the other? Because that's the one that I think a lot of parents worry about missing out on noticing.
Yeah, so it's 9 to 11, but I would say, like, you know, depending on the child, but around 10 is the sweet spot there, right? So parents helping their kids make that transition and letting go and giving them that time in order to, you know, be by themselves and be with their friends, not around other people, unsupervised.
Now, due to the pandemic, we have widespread unemployment, and even people who still have jobs have to take maybe pay cuts or furlough days. What can we offer parents in the way of affordable ideas for things to do with their kids this summer?
Well, it's great to be active together. So bike, hike, play tennis. There's tons of free online classes, going camping, exploring different neighborhoods, hanging out at the park and bringing back traditional board games. Things like that are really great. But I would say really think about what the goal is of why you were doing that experience previously. So if you're, you know, you were going to go to a museum because you wanted to explore art, can you do that virtually? Also maybe creatively thinking about how to create a camp experience for yourself. A couple of summers ago, a friend of mine and I just swapped off every Wednesday, and we planned a couple of hours in the morning for our kids. And I would plan, you know, art and design classes, and she would plan music and acting classes. And we were able to take the skills of our friends and our group in order to be able to create activities for kids.
Lastly, one last thing. There's already that summer slide that always happens, right? Sometimes kids, when they go back to school in the fall during normal times, have this little gap of learning. But I'm wondering, with everything that's happened the last few months, how much should parents worry about this summer?
I don't think parents should really worry about it, because by participating in these other activities, they are learning, and they're learning other things that are very important. But if they're concerned about learning, it's pretty amazing to see what's out there in terms of personalized educational software. You know, one of the experiences, I have an 8-year-old son, and we've tried out 4 or 5 different software programs. And if you don't understand something, then it takes you further into detail. If you do understand something, it advances you, which is really hard to do in a classroom of 28 to 35 students. So if parents are really interested in educational opportunities, that's what I would recommend. And many of these programs have a couple of months for free.
That's Christina Costello. She's the author of the book, Designing for Kids, Creating for Playing, Learning, and Growing. Christina, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you so much.